Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to continue our study in the book of Hebrews, and tonight we're going to be in a preparatory passage for next week. But it was too much to deal with the whole thing in 1 week, so I'm going to go 1 through 10 tonight, which is really a detailed description of the ancient tabernacle in the wilderness. And I hope I passed out as many little diagrams of the tabernacle as I made copies of. I hope that while I go through here, that you will put the scripture references that are in your notes. And if you need a bulletin, they're over there with the outline. Anybody need a bulletin? Craig, would you get those bulletins for me? And if you'll put the scripture references by the different things we're going to talk about, I think it'll become helpful to you. Okay. So indeed, the first covenant. Now, how many of you have King James tonight with you? Okay. You'll notice it has the word also there. Also has its ordinances. The word also is not in the most ancient Greek manuscripts. And I know you get sick of me talking about that. But it is very important for me that we realize that we want as best as we can to get back to the original words of the apostles. And it is obvious as you look at some Greek manuscripts that things have been added. Now I want to give you three books that if you're interested in how you got the English Bible that sits in your lap, the process it went through, the background that it came through, if you're interested in that, let me make a couple of suggestions to you. Number one, there is an Oxford History of the Church in three volumes, paperback. The first volume deals with these manuscripts. Excellent. A book by a man that I trust very much, known as F.F. Bruce, a little green book called The Books and the Parchments. Excellent book to find out where we got the English Bible. And finally, if you're really interested in it, you want to do a little more detailed study, a book by Bruce Metzger, who teaches at Princeton, called New Testament Criticism. I think it's called Criticism of the New Testament. But anyway, you can find it in the bookstore. I think that'll be helpful to you. This word also is not found in the earliest Greek manuscript we have, the Chester Beatty Papyri. It is also not found in one of the most ancient manuscripts of the whole Bible, known as the Vaticanus. And it really goofs up the whole argument to have the word also in there. It was added by a scribe as he thought it didn't fit well, so he added a word so you'd understand it better, and by adding it, he took away from the argument. So you can check me on that. I wish you would. And worship of its earthly sanctuary. Now, the author is setting us up. He's going to use a typological description of the earthly tabernacle whose pattern was given to Moses by God, a copy of the true tabernacle in heaven, where God first met man on an individual kind of basis, as well as a corporate basis, where God dwelt symbolically above the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant mercy seat. He's going to use that as an analogy to the better covenant in Jesus Christ. Now, to set up that analogy, he's going to have to tell us a little bit about the tabernacle. Now, that seems rather funny that he would have to tell a bunch of Hebrews about the tabernacle. But, of course, they were living in a day when Solomon's temple was the place of sacrifice. And maybe they weren't as familiar with this ancient tabernacle as they were with Solomon's temple. So, maybe that's the reason. And he goes in verse 2, and he says, "For the first or outer part of the tent." Now, if you look at your diagram, what we're talking about is this area known as the holy place. Now, there are two divisions of this inner shrine known as the holy place and the holy of holies. The holy place had some particular furniture in it and some particular procedures and regulations the priest went through. So let's look at that if we could. Notice mine says, "For the first or outer part of the tent," and you can put up top there, "tabernacle, CF, Exodus 25. That's where it's discussed in detail. It's Exodus 25. which is called the holy place, was equipped with, number one, the lamp. Now, do you have lampstand, maybe, some of you? Notice it's singular. It is the seven-pointed lampstand that in Hebrew is known as the menorah. One central trunk, three branches on each side. On the top of each branch was a cup-shaped device where olive oil was placed and a wick was protruding out of the olive oil. This olive oil had to be replenished daily for a light forever burned in the holy place. Now, we learn later on that in Solomon's temple, they put 10 lampstands, 5 on each side of this holy place. But the author, of course, is speaking about this early tabernacle. Let me give you the other references if you're interested. In 1 Kings 7:49 and 2 Chronicles 4:7, the size of this thing, I'll give to you in cubits, because that's what the biblical records, biblical Bible. Now, what is a cubit? It is the length of a man's elbow to a man's longest finger. Averages 18 to so inches. So it was 30 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 10 cubits tall. And that's the size, okay? 20 cubits long, 10 cubits wide, 10 cubits tall. I missed it up. 20 long, 10 wide, 10 tall. If you multiply 10 times 18, you'll get about how many feet it was, okay? It's not a real big place. Then we have the table and the presentation bread. You'll see it's listed on your sheet. Also here was a short table covered with gold. And on that table, 12 large loaves of bread are placed every week. They have something to do with the presence symbolically of the tribes before God. It's not explained a whole lot about this, the purpose of this, but we have several biblical references to it. Of course, Exodus 25, 23 through 30, Leviticus 24, 5 through 9. There's a very interesting biblical reference related to this bread in 1 Samuel 21, 1 through 6. Only the priest could eat this bread after it was a week old, and they didn't have any bamboo steamers or nothing, you know. Week old, big old loaf of bread, several pound loaf. Man, it made Mrs. Baird cry how big this loaf was. And they could eat only, the priest. But David and his army came through one time, hungry as they could be, and the priest had nothing to feed them, but he fed them the week old presence bread. And Jesus makes allusion to this in the New Testament. And so we see that it wasn't as dogmatic a thing as we often make it, because here's an example of soldiers being fed this bread. You say, how could 12 loaves of bread feed soldiers? These are big loaves of bread. Now, then it's continuing then in verse 3. Behind the second curtain. Now, in Hebrew, there are specific names for the first curtain. If you look at your chart, I've put the first curtain a little bit in from the opening. But I want you to know this opening is open. The people who were offering the sacrifices could see into the holy place. They could look in and they could see that light, that candle stand. They could see that table of showbread. They could see that. This first curtain was not a solid curtain that blocked vision out. Okay? It was often pulled back or thin enough you could see through. The first curtain. But the second curtain is the dark line. It was a thick curtain. Some of the rabbis say it was a double curtain a foot apart. But everything biblically that we know, it is one single curtain, thick with purple and red and blue thread with the picture of the cherubim on it, hung from golden hooks on an acacia wood pole in silver sockets. It is fancy. It is fancy. Now, it is what completely veils off this inner shrine. It's known as the Holy of Holies. It was a perfect cube. 10 cubits, 10 cubits, 10 cubits. And in this center room is where the high priest entered only once a year. Now, the rabbis say he entered 4 times on one particular day. But be that as it may, this is a special room where God symbolically dwelt with his people. Let's look at it. For the second curtain is the tent, which is called the Holy of Holies. Now, look at verse 4 real close to me, because there's a real problem here. Mine has, with its golden incense altar. Now, what do you have? With its censer? Golden censer. Now, if you're familiar with Exodus 25 at all, and if you've read through this before you came tonight, you'll know that there's one piece of furniture left out of this. And that's the golden incense altar. And you'll also know that there's nothing, biblically speaking, in that Holy of Holies but the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the author is either misinformed, he's just plain in error, or something is happening. Now, I have real problems with an inspired writer goofing up the tabernacle furniture. You know, that just bothers me. I can see it if he was writing, you know, a history about it, but in the book, it bothers me we have a piece of furniture out of place. So let me show you what I do when I come to a text like this and how I try to see if there's any way that we can understand this. First of all, I want to know what the Hebrew word behind this Greek word means. I need to see how it's used in the Bible. Now, lo and behold, this word is used in the Septuagint. And the reason that's so important is all of these words in Greek do not come from their Greek background, but come from their use in the Bible of the Hebrew people in the day which Jesus lived, the Septuagint. Very few Jews spoke Hebrew. Okay? So the Bible had to be put in a language they could understand. And the first translation of that was the Septuagint. You've heard me mention several times the word Targums. Targums is the name of the Aramaic translation of the Old Testament. So I want to see what this Hebrew word means and how it's used in the Septuagint. The Greek word used in the Septuagint often means incense altar. We learn from Philo, Jewish believer in Alexandria, Egypt, who wrote a lot, and Josephus, Jewish person in the time of Jesus who went over to the Romans and wrote some books about history, that this word can mean an incense altar. But it's used in the Old Testament, Hebrew, always for a censer. Now, in Hebrew, what it really means is not the little fire pan. It's often called King James fire pan. It was some kind of object with a long handle where the incense was put there and the smoke would come out. Now, the smoke was for the purpose of protecting man from seeing God and dying. So, the word in Hebrew means the place of incense burning. It can mean a censer or it can mean an altar. It just means the place where incense is burned. So we have those two different backgrounds. Now, let me give you the places it's used for a censer. Leviticus 16:12 in Hebrew, the word there is used. Now, it's also used in the Septuagint, 2 Chronicles 26:19, Ezekiel 8:11. And Sam, you ought to have in that Bible you showed me, the book of 4th Maccabees. If you'd look it up for me, chapter 7, verse 11, it ought to be the word there. Just check it for me and see if it is. Now, what is the problem here? It's obviously that this incense altar, and I think that's what the word means instead of censer. It is obvious that this is not in the holy place. If you'll notice on the thing, I put it right in front of the veil. It's probably a little smaller than that. The box should be a little smaller, but I put it right in front of the second veil. How could this author goof up such a major piece of tabernacle furniture and put it in the wrong place? Well, I think 1 Kings 6:22 really helps me, along with Exodus 30:1 through 10. This particular piece of furniture is very important to the ritual that is connected with the Ark of the Covenant. It is the only piece of furniture in the whole tabernacle area that is directly related to the Day of Atonement. Now, in 1 Kings 6:22, it's sitting right in front of the second veil, but its purpose is related to the Ark of the Covenant, which is inside that second veil. And it seems what the author is saying is this piece of furniture, although located in the outer tabernacle shrine, relates primarily to the inner tabernacle shrine. That's the best I can do. But I think that is probably what it's talking about. it seems to us it's an obvious problem, but really I think the author is identifying its use with the Ark of the Covenant, and that's what's mentioned next. And the chest for the covenant. You might want to see Exodus 25, 10 through 22. I think I'm going to handle these different sections when I get through tonight. Number two, tradition as to the location of the Ark of the Covenant, and tradition to where the Ark is now, and the contents of it, we'll deal at the conclusion tonight, okay? But it's a very important piece of furniture. We're not going to discuss it in detail here. How many of you saw the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark? You see that? Good. I thought it was a good show, too. The Ark of the Covenant, as depicted in that movie, in my opinion, was probably representative of what it did look like. As far as we can know, that was a pretty good representation. Dimensionally, it was about the right size. The cherubim, in my opinion, looked a little honky, but, you know. But that was pretty close, okay? If you remember the picture of those two angelic beings with their wings that meet in the middle and those two poles that slid on each side of the ark, remember how the lid came off? That's pretty biblical. Inside that wasn't sand, Bible, but was some other things. And so that was pretty representative, I think. It really was. They did some good homework on that. Now, and I want to cover what's in the ark and on the next verse. Now, listen to where it says, covered with pure gold, and in it a golden jar which held the manna. Now, the word golden doesn't come from the Hebrew Bible. It comes from the Septuagint. And over I've told you, this author is not using the Old Testament that you had translated in your English Bible. He's using the Septuagint. And it really is a different translation. Many of us have thought it's simply a bunch of Jews got together and interpreted the Masoretic text. But since the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it is obvious that the Septuagint is an accurate Greek translation of a variant manuscript that is as old as the Masoretic text that you have in your Bible. So more and more, this translation is gaining credibility in scholarly circles for truly accurate representation of the Old Testament. Now, the jar, Josephus tells it holds 4 pints. Now, I don't know how much it held, but the manna was stuff that, you know, it fell, and they collected it every day, except on the Sabbath. They collected it on Friday enough for 2 days, Thursday enough for 2 days. And so, the author says that this little container of manna was placed inside the ark. He also, and that we'll see Exodus 16, 31 through 36, this manna deal. Then Aaron's staff that budded. Now, we only have two brief allusions to this in the Old Testament. Numbers 17, 1 through 11 is where there was a rebellion. They said, bring the staffs of the people, and in the morning God will choose who should be the priest. And Aaron's rod, staff was the only one that broke out in blossoms. Okay? Now, that was put inside the ark, the author of Hebrews says. Later on, in Numbers chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, this is the staff that Moses used to strike the rock, and water poured out. It's the only reference anywhere in the Bible to it. Okay? And the tablets on which the covenant was written, that's Exodus 25, 16, and 17, those are the tablets that Moses, the second time up on Mount Sinai, remember he got one copy that God wrote, and he came down and found the golden calf and got mad and broke them. Then he had to go back up and get another copy. And this is the copy that's supposedly in the Ark of the Covenant. Now, by Solomon's day, Solomon's temple, the only thing that was in the Ark of the Covenant were these two tables of law. Now, let me go ahead and do it here. Look on your outline. Number two, tradition after the content of the Ark. Now, I've got two things listed for you, rabbinical tradition and beside the Ark. Let me surprise you that the Bible never says, the Old Testament, that the manna and the rod were in the ark. What it says is they were laid before the Lord, before the Ark of the Testimony. Now, rabbis say they were laid outside the ark, close, but outside. Now, here's rabbinical tradition. What they say is in the ark. The two tables of stone, of course, that God wrote, Moses brought down from Sinai, two silver columns that relate or hold up those tables of stone, fragments of the original broken stones, right? They don't know messing around. A copy of the Torah, Deuteronomy 31:26, and the names for God. Now, boy, that's straight out of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. the power that's involved in knowing God's names. Now, they say beside the ark is the pot of manna, Aaron's rod, and those jewels. Do anybody know where those jewels come from? Remember the jewels that... Do you remember this story? Remember the golden hemorrhoids? Yes, yes. Remember the Philistines took the ark from Eli's sons? And they took them to the temple of their god, Dragon. And suddenly the place was inflicted with hemorrhoids and mice. Everybody got hemorrhoids, mice were everywhere. They said, oh, we don't need this. We just don't need this. And so they built little golden copies of the mice and little golden copies of the hemorrhoids. Put them back in the ark with jewels on a driverless cart and sent that thing back to Israel. The jewels they sent back, the rabbis say, were placed beside the ark. Okay? So, and we know by from 1 Kings 8, 9 that by Solomon's day, the only thing in the ark was those two tables of law. The rest had either been stolen, misplaced, or they never were in there. So, I don't know which it is. Now, then it mentions, and above the chest were the winged creatures, the symbol of God's glorious presence, overshadowing the mercy seat. Now, these are the cherubim. One of, that's plural, one of them is a cherub. And I want to talk a little bit tonight about what these things look like, because they're very interesting. The reason I want to do this is people tend to make such simple statements about things in the Bible without realizing the terrible complexity of the Bible itself on certain issues. Example, what does a cherub look like? Well, it depends on where you go in the Bible. There is really some difference about these angelic creatures. Now, the first time we find them is where? Remember? It is a cherub that guards the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve ran out. The sword that goes all directions, that was a cherub that was guarding the Garden of Eden. There's several references to them. There's another reference in Exodus 25, 18 through 22. There's another reference in Ezekiel chapter 1. Remember the wheels that spinned around, those strange creatures in Ezekiel's vision? Those were cherubs. They're specifically talked about, again, in Ezekiel 10, 19 and following, or 1 and following, really. And they're also mentioned in Revelation chapter 4. They are around the throne of God. The living creatures of Revelation are the cherubim. Now, let's see if we can find some kind of description based on the Bible. Let me show you what's happening here, how difficult this gets. Let's just look at the way they look, their faces. Now, one of the things that bothered me in the Raiders of the Lost Ark is those two angels, if you notice, had human faces, young, male kind of faces, right? Remember seeing them? And they had one face, and they pointed inward toward the Ark of the Covenant, toward the middle of the mercy seat. But the cherubs in the Bible were composite creatures with many faces. Let's look. In Ezekiel 10:14, it lists four different faces. In Revelation 4:7, it lists four different faces. One was the face of a man, one was the face of a lion, one was the face of an eagle, and one was the face of an ox. Now, if you go back to Ezekiel, it says one was the face of a cherub. So apparently a cherub and an ox are the same things if you compare Revelation and Ezekiel. So they had four faces. How'd you like to meet that thing in the dark? Okay? But the Bible doesn't stop there. If you look in the same book of Ezekiel, chapter 41, verse 18, it clearly says, here is a cherub that has two faces. So we've got a four-faced cherub and a two-faced cherub. You say, well, that's no problem. How about the number of wings? On the movie recently, how many wings do those cherubs have? You remember seeing? Two wings, both outstretched, almost met over the center of the ark, okay? In Revelation 4:8, they had six wings, just like the seraphim in the book of Isaiah chapter 6, verse 2. Remember the seraphim? Totally different order of angelic creatures. Six wings. Two they fly, two they cover their face, two they cover their feet. And they're the ones that are saying, holy, holy, holy all the time. It's exactly what the cherubs of Revelation 4 are singing, holy, holy, holy. Okay, six wings. But wait a minute, Ezekiel chapter 10, verse 21 says they have four wings. And in 1 Kings 6:24, it seems they have two wings. Well, look how complicated it gets. We're not sure what these things look like. Archaeologists dig around over there, and they find the winged bull of Assyria. And they say, obviously, this was a cherub. We don't know. We just don't know from the Bible what a cherub looked like. But these angelic creatures are particularly associated with the presence of God, the protection of God. Many times in the Psalms it says, God rides on the cherub. And so that's the kind of creature we're looking at. But it's very hard to link in exactly what they are. Okay, when it says a symbol of God's presence, you might want to see Leviticus 16:2 and 1 Samuel 4:4, where it calls them the cherub of the glory or the presence of God. Now, the mercy seat here, I want to deal with that word for a minute. That is the very same word that's used in Romans 3:25 for the word propitiation. And it's a word that is, if you take it from Greek, it means to appease an angry God. I don't think we ought to take these Greek words from the Greek etymology, but from the usage in the Septuagint. In the Septuagint, it refers to the mercy seat, that special lid where on one special day a year the high priest sprinkled the blood to cover the sins of the people. It was the place where God met man in forgiveness. Now, what is the Jewish name for the Day of Atonement? Anybody remember? What's that day called? Yom Kippur. The Hebrew words did not have any vowels recorded until the 9th century A.D. So the Hebrew consonants for this word are KPR. Now, KPR means to cover. But from an Akkadian cognate, we find it means to completely wipe away. So here we have a verb that's used at the top of this seat, which means a place where man's sins are wiped away, where man's sin is dealt with, where God dwells above the wings of those cherubim. It's where God, remember those beautiful pictures in Psalms where it says God is enthroned upon the praises of Israel? Well, that's the picture right there above the top of that Ark of the Covenant, where God's presence dwelt, where Moses went in to talk to God. The smoke from the censer was to protect man from seeing God and dying. That's where the Shekinah glory came down the tabernacle and spoke with Moses, right above that Ark of the Covenant. Let's go to verse 6 then, if we could. With these arrangements completed in this way, the priests, in conducting their official services, regularly go in to the outer part of the tent of worship. They went in for three reasons, and I think I have them listed for you here. Yeah, number 11. They go in to keep the lights burning, Exodus 27, 20 through 28. They go in to replace the bread, Leviticus 24, 8 and 9. And they go in to place incense daily, Exodus 37 through 8. So they're all the time in that outer tent. But into the second or inner part, nobody but the high priest may go once a year. Now that's the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, Leviticus 16. And if you want to see the ritual of that day, I hope you'll read Leviticus 16. And never without blood, which he offers for himself, it's a sin offering before he goes in for the people, and for the sins committed in ignorance by the people. There's a misprint on your outline, number 13. Instead of the high, it's the sin of the high hand. And what that means is, and this may surprise you, there is no Old Testament sacrifice for premeditated sin. If you thought through and planned out an act of sin against God, there was no sacrifice to take away that sin. Let me give you two references that I think will really surprise you. Leviticus 4, 2, Numbers 15, 27 and 30. For intentional sins, there was no sacrifice. Remember Psalms 51 when David was agonizing with his sin with Bathsheba and the death of Uriah and all of that? And he says, I would offer sacrifice, but what you want is a broken and contrite heart. What David was saying is, if I could get away by simply offering a sacrifice, I would. But what I did, there is no sacrifice for it. Nothing's available. Now, By this, the Holy Spirit, that's usually used to give us an Old Testament quote, but here it's just a way of talking about the inspiration of the Old Testament. This author is not negating the Old Testament. He's trying to prove the superiority of the covenant of Jesus. Now, we're showing that there was as yet no access to the real sanctuary while the outer tent was still in existence. A lot of people want to say, this proves that something about A.D. 70. One of the real problems of those of us who try so desperately to put these New Testament books in a historical context is why nowhere in the New Testament is the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple under the Roman general Titus in A.D. 70 mentioned. And it seems so unusual. That was such a major event, especially for Jewish people. And most people put the book of Hebrews after A.D. 70. It's never mentioned. It's never alluded to. And I don't think this is an allusion to that. It's simply saying, while this structure is still in vogue, man can't really come to God. Now, the priest can get so far, and the high priest can go in, but man can't really come in. I think the symbolism, when Jesus died and the inner veil was ripped from top to bottom, not bottom to top as man would do it, but top to bottom, when Jesus died, is saying the same kind of thing the author of Hebrews is, that Jesus is a new covenant that takes us directly into the presence of God. Remember I told you, one of the things that this author is primarily concerned about is access to God. How do we get to God? And what he's saying is, as long as this outer thing was in vogue, as long as they were still doing this, we couldn't really get in to access to God. And he continues, for it is merely a symbol of the present time in connection with the gifts and sacrifices which are repeatedly offered. I hope you were here for chapter 8 where he talks about once and for all Jesus compared to the over and over sacrifice of the priest. Offered though they cannot make the conscience of the worshiper perfect. Now here is the real crux. What he's saying is this kind of ritual went on and on and on. There were thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent animals killed. There was blood up to your knees poured out. There was flies and stink and burned flesh. You can't imagine the gore of Old Testament sacrificial system. How would you like to kill about 1,000 sheep in our parking lot? Well, multiply that many times over and you know what Jerusalem smelled like around Mount Moriah. I bet it was horrendous. So the incense helped a little bit, you know. But, boy, what a bloody mess that thing was. Cow bleeding. Well, no, sheep bleed, don't they? Cows were moo-mooing and the sheep were bleeding. And man, it was death. Pigeons were being ripped apart. My goodness, can you imagine that? Well, all of that did not deal with the man's inner heart and motives. Now, it dealt with ritual. It was a God-given ritual to set the stage for Christ. It is important that we look at Christ's life and death in an Old Testament setting. We need to see the sacrificial system as setting the stage for Christ's perfect sacrifice. But that Old Testament system, it's going to say in a few chapters, the blood of bulls and goats never took away sin. It was an outward ritual. It never dealt with the heart, the conscience, the motives, the inner life of man, which Jesus deals with. And then it continues, since they deal only with food and drink and various washings, that is, the mere material regulations which are enforced only until the time. And what do you have in your translation? New order? Okay, somebody else? Setting things right? The Reformation? Okay. Will reform all things? Okay. Anybody else? Someone have setting things straight? Anybody? Well, you can tell by the variety of translations, this word can't be succinct down into one word. Mine has the time of setting things straight. This is a medical term for the setting of a broken leg. It is used in Jeremiah 7:3 and 5 in a moral sense. Now, Rabbinically, these guys are Jews. They understand Old Testament phraseology. Rabbinically speaking, it refers to the ultimate year of Jubilee. Remember that? Every 50 years, all debts are restored, all lands. Jews never did it, but they were supposed to. It is the ultimate Jubilee when the coming of the Messiah will occur. And that's what it's referred to in Judaism, and I think that's what it's referring to here. Okay, before I take questions, I want to deal with this tradition as to the location of the ark. I think it's interesting. Where is that thing? You know, we've lost that. How did we lose it? Where did it go? First of all, I think God took that from us so we wouldn't worship as an idol. Because, you know, we're just prone as we can be to do that. The very snake that God told Moses to make and put up on a standard to save those folks from Numbers 21, became an idol to be worshipped and had to be burned later. God wouldn't give us that ark for nothing. He knows what we'd do with it. We'd bow down, kiss it, put it on a pedestal, everything. Taken by Pharaoh in Zedekiah's day. If you've been here on Wednesday night, we've been in Jeremiah at least since 1932. I feel like I've been in Jeremiah forever. Remember, Pharaoh put Zedekiah on the throne after the death of Josiah at Megiddo. So Pharaoh may have taken those temple treasures to him to Egypt. Now that's what that movie's based on, isn't it? Isn't it? The Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's where that thing got in Egypt, supposedly. Most scholars believe that it was taken by Nebuchadnezzar at the fall of Jerusalem a few years later, 586 B.C. That he took it back to Babylon, either melted it down or something, but it went to Babylon. Now here's some rabbinical places. It was hidden by Jeremiah on Mount Nebo at the fall of Jerusalem. Jeremiah was pretty old. Can you see him carrying the Ark of the Covenant by himself to Mount Nebo? Well, number four, Second Baruch. Same that should be in that Bible too. Second Baruch says, an angel hid them. All right. Number five, hidden by unknown means, but Elijah, when he returns to prepare for the Messiah, will bring it with him. That comes from Malachi 3, doesn't it? Messiah, Elijah will prepare the way. That's, you know, okay? Number six, Samaritans say it's hidden on Mount Gerizim. Now, why would they say that? That's their mountain. That's right. They want to make that mountain better than Moriah in Jerusalem, so they say, no, it's hidden here with us. We have no idea what happened to that stuff. I think the best guess, either Nebuchadnezzar took it to Babylon, never to return. Because really, if it went to Babylon, you'd think that Nehemiah was such friends with the Persian kings. And they gave him so many of the vessels of the house of the Lord to take back with him, you know, to rebuild Jerusalem. You'd think he'd have given him that ark if it was still in existence a few years later in the Persian period. But we hear nothing about it. Probably Nebuchadnezzar, because of all that gold, melted everything down, took it back as gold bullion, and burnt the wood. Because we never see it again. It never appears. Never mentioned. Now, a few cups, a few incensers, a few vessels, yes, but never the special ark. Never the altar of incense. Never the menorah. Never the table of showbread. All gone. So probably that's what happened. Well, we're kind of in the Old Testament tonight in this tabernacle setting, and I'd be happy to talk with you about this. The real meat of this section is going to be next week when we compare Jesus' ministry to this ministry. But I thought it would be good tonight for us to mention the tabernacle in the wilderness. Any questions? Yes, Craig? Four living creatures? Yes. And the reason it never calls them cherubim in Revelation, but their description as to their four faces are exactly the description that is in the book of Ezekiel, and they are called cherubim there. So it never says what they are, it just says the four living creatures. But they don't fit the discussion of the seraphim, and they are exactly like Ezekiel's cherubim. There are several orders of angels. I was reading tonight before I came in here in the Zondervan Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia, which I've encouraged you to buy, under cherubim. And biblically speaking, there are numerous orders of angels I don't think we think about. There's the cherubs, mentioned several times in the Bible. There's the seraphim, right? Different order. There is the angel of the Lord, which I often think is really the pre-incarnate Christ many times. There is the archangels. Got a couple of angels named, Michael and Gabriel, book of Daniel. One of them is the prince of the nation. And do you realize that the New Testament, the terms principalities and powers, forces of darkness, those are also angelic order. It's just the reverse side is the fallen angels. So there are numerous lists of the orders of angels that we know little or nothing about. God has not wanted us to worry about all these supernatural personages and powers and orders that really are involved in our world. But there are numerous orders that relate to man, that relate to God, and back and forth. But isn't it unusual that God has not wanted to satisfy our curiosity by telling us a whole lot about them, because they really don't relate to us right now as far as salvation or doing the will of God or living the Christian life? He just don't. So he just hadn't told. The Bible's not a book to answer your curiosity. Yes. Yeah, Uriah. No. Here's those paradoxical things. See, you know, what happened is that thing is holy. And everybody's afraid to death to get too close to God, right? He said, you come too close to the mountain, you'll die. And so there's a real fear and holiness around where God's presence is. But you got to remember that there were Levites who went into that holy place. And it says just the high priest. But that's not true. Now, think biblically. Who else had to go in that holy place and touch that ark? The people who moved it. And they moved it all the time. They tore that tent down, the Levites, not the priests, Levites, but the other Levites. They went in that, pulled the curtains down, folded them up, put them in a box, carried. You see, now they covered the ark with a covering when they marched before the army. But that ark was out a whole lot. And so many people fiddled with that thing. Now the reason Uriah died, remember, it was coming back to Jerusalem. David was moving it in, and it started to fall off the cart, and this man grabbed it to keep from falling, and he died. Remember how mad David got at God for that? Well, I think a lot of it was in that man's mind, you know. He said, my goodness, I've touched the Ark of the Covenant, and bang, you know. Some of those things we just don't know all it's about. But I think, and I'm going to use a word, and I want to... There was such an emotional taboo to that thing that I think it was that man's reaction more than it was God's reaction. You know, like you would jump out in the street to save a child from a car, okay? If you had to think about it, you probably wouldn't do it. None of us would probably. If you had to sit down and think, now, should I do this or not? I think that guy touched the ark, and then it scared him to death what he'd done. But this thing about a supernatural generator, yucko. Does that make any sense? Remember that Philistines captured it and lost the war, so it wasn't as powerful as they thought it was. Yes, Dorothy? Yeah, the word golden's not in the Hebrew. It's in the Septuagint. Philo and the Septuagint are the only ones to mention it being gold. In the Hebrew text, it's just an earthen jar that you could tap, seal, like the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in that kept, Josephus says, 4 pints of manna. Isn't it unusual? Just here again is the inconsistency of trying to think all this thing out through Western history. Remember, if you gathered too much manna, if you tried to gather manna for 2 days on a regular day of the week, what happened? It went to worms. But one day a week, you could gather it for 2 days, and then it went to worms. But here's a jar of it in the Ark of the Covenant for years and didn't turn to worms. Yeah, it could have been. Sure could have been. I saw their hand. Yes? Yes. Yes, I think so. But of course, the real problem with that is toward the end of Revelation, it says there is no more temple.